Okay, let's start from the beginning of the Sedra and see as many things as we can do. Torah starts, Kiseitse la milchoma aloivecha. You go out to war against your enemy. So the Mefarshim say that this euphemistically refers to the battle that a person has to do with his Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is the biggest enemy that a person has. And when you go to war with your enemy, this is the hint. There's only one problem. This war has to be talking about a war that you don't have to make. Melchemes Reshus. Because in the wars that you're commanded to do, you don't take any hostages. You have to kill men, women, and children. So this is talking about taking a hostage, or not a hostage, taking a captive. So it can't be talking about a war that you have to do. It has to be talking about a voluntary war. So if that's the case, where's the connection? The fight with the Yetzer Hara is a mandatory battle. How could the fight with the Yetzer Hara be hinted to in a war that is only voluntary? So one possible answer, I think, is the following. There is a Kliyoker in the beginning of the Torah who says that the Rabbanan say, the Gemara says, that the Yetzer Hara is like a fly. Okay, and there's many comparisons to the Yetzer Hara and a fly. One of them is flies are very persistent. Right? You can sweat, as long as you don't kill it, right, the fly keeps coming back. He doesn't get, right. If you hit a dog, right, or you kick it, right, the dog knows, stay away from this person, or a cat. But a fly, no matter what you do, you don't kill it, it keeps coming back. So the Yetzer Hara doesn't leave you alone. You can do everything, it still comes back. Okay, in any case, but another comparison he says is the following. If you have a whole apple, the fly can't touch it. But if you take a bite out of the apple, then the fly can do his work on that apple. Lepesa chatas rovets. The Yetzer Hara is waiting for a Pesach. He's waiting for an opening. If you don't give him the opening, then he doesn't have any power against you. But once you give him a little bit of an opening, you give him a finger, he takes an arm. So Memela, I think that's the idea. If you start to fight the Yetzer Hara when it's mandatory, you've lost the battle. You have to fight the Yetzer Hara on those areas that aren't mandatory. You have to take the first initiative in those things that are mutter, but control yourself and teach yourself discipline even for the permissible things, then you'll be able to fight the Yetzer Hara for the prohibited things. But if you don't take the initiative on the things that are permissible and you start the war on the things that are prohibited, you've already lost the war. Okay. So there's another hint over here. It says you bring this captive woman and she goes through a process where in the end it could end with conversion, but it's a quick conversion, right, with all kinds of laws, right, and the let's backtrack a second. Right, what happened over here? Let's see what the Torah is talking about. A guy goes into battle, he sees this beautiful woman, she doesn't have to be beautiful, beautiful in his eyes, and is allowed to take her as a captive, and according to some opinions, which is the easier one to explain, he can't live with her until he'll put her through this whole process, and in the end, if he still wants to marry her, she basically converts, becomes Jewish, and then he can marry her. If not, then he has to let her go. Can't sell her to somebody else or whatever, she just lets her go free. What's the process? The process is he brings her home and he shaves her head. He cuts her fingernails off, according to one opinion. Another opinion, first he lets them grow and then cuts them off. He takes off the beautiful dresses that the Goyish women would wear to seduce the enemy soldiers. Puts on a plain dress, not the fancy dresses that she wore in the time of the war, and she sits in the house and cries for 30 days for her mother and her father. Okay, and after that, if she agrees to convert, then fine. If not, then you send her free. Okay, so the Zohar says that the 30 days of crying is a hint to the month of Elul. somehow there's a connection between what we're supposed to do this month and the crying of this captive woman for 30 days. So I think there's a few ideas here. One is, what is she crying for? What are we making her cry for? So one idea is that she's crying as closure. The Ramban says it's like a velus, 30 days of mourning. You give this woman 30 days to mourn for her father and mother. She doesn't know what happened to them. Maybe they died in the war. It's only menschlich to let this woman, before you start talking about marriages, let this woman mourn for her parents. They're goyim, but they're her parents. So let her mourn for her parents. She doesn't know if they were killed in the war or not. We didn't have any mitzvah to kill them. But it could be they didn't survive. So cry for them. And cry over the fact that she's now being separated from her religion, whatever religion she had before. Cry for that. Another idea is that she already reached a level where she's so enamored with Judaism. She's been in this house, Jewish house, for 30 days, sees the difference between what goes on here and what went on in her Goyisha house. So she's crying over the fact that her parents didn't have the opportunity to convert also, to experience this, the beauty of what Judaism is. That's what she's crying for. Basically, there's a Shari Tshuva who says the following. There is two different sources as to what the order of tshuva is. Right? There are different stages to tshuva, right? Components of tshuva. The first component, according to everybody, is recognize that you sinned. If you don't recognize you sin, there's nothing to get started. You can't do tshuva if you don't know you sinned. So the first thing is hakaras hachet, recognize that you sinned. Now the second component, in some sources it said, the first thing after that is regret that you sinned. If you recognize you sin, but you don't regret it, so why would you want to do tshuva? So the next thing is regret it. Then comes the next component, stop doing it. Okay, you regret it, stop it. Now you can work on fixing up the past. You stop. Okay. And then comes the Kabbalah La'asid. You accept that you won't do it anymore. You commit yourself not to do it again, and you confess it. Those are the stages of tshuva. In another source, the order is different. First, recognize the sin. Then stop doing it. Then regret it. So the question is, which comes first, the regret or the stopping to do the sin? So the Shari Tshuva says there's no contradiction. It depends what kind of sin. A sin that you have done over and over again and gotten in the habit of doing, there's no way that you're going to regret doing that sin right out. Because you're so in the habit of doing it, it becomes commonplace for you. Nothing to regret. How do you come to regret such a sin? Stop doing it. And the more you stop, the more you realize that maybe it was something you should regret. Example, somebody who smokes. When he's still a chain smoker, it's hard for him to regret smoking. He enjoys it, right? He's used to it. When does he regret it? When he stops for a while. The more he stops and gets out of the habit, the more he can look back and regret ever doing it. But you can't regret it while you're in the midst of doing it. So first you have to stop, then you can come to regret. But if it's a sin that you only did out of character one time, unusual, then usually immediately after doing it you regret it, and that will bring you to stop doing it. So sins that are habitual, you have to first stop in order to get to the regret. And sins that are out of character one time, you can regret, then that will bring you to stop doing it. First you regret, then you stop. That's the Shari Tshuva. There's only one problem. If you don't, I understand if you regret doing something, you'll stop doing it. But if you don't regret it, what's going to make you stop? The answer is very simple. Sometimes there are circumstances, right, which even if you don't regret it, you have no choice. For example, let's go back to the guy who smokes. He's a habitual smoker. He loves smoking. Okay, he doesn't regret doing it because he's accepted it as a fact of life. Smoke, you smoke. Goes for a checkup, doctor says, you have emphysema. You don't stop smoking, you're going to be dead in 6 months. That is a good incentive to stop. Even though he doesn't regret it. He doesn't regret smoking, he'd love to continue. But there's no choice. The doctor told him, if he doesn't stop smoking, he's going to die in 6 months. So he better stop. So there are things that can create a necessity to stop something, even if you don't regret it. Okay. One of those things, when it comes to sins, is Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. If you believe that you're judged every Rosh Hashanah for what's going to be the next year, and the judgment takes in consideration what you're doing, and if you don't do tshuva, right, then the judgment is a lot more negative, okay? So you may not regret doing the sins, right? I don't regret speaking Lashon Hara. I do it every day, have an hour set aside, talk to the phone, on the phone with my neighbor, right, and we go over the whole community or whatever, and I don't regret it, right? I'm in the habit of doing it every morning. But now I look up on the calendar, and I see it's Rosh Chodesh Elul, and in a month it's going to be Rosh Hashanah, and I really would like to have a good year. And I know that this is something that's going not to be something I want to bring to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So I may not regret it. I have no choice. I have to start cutting down on my Lashon Hara session every day. Okay. So that's the same thing over here. Over here, this woman has to make a cheshbon. Look, I may not have wanted to be a captive in this Jewish guy's house. Right. I may have loved to stay with my parents, with my old religion, or whatever. But right now, circumstances are that if I don't come to the realization that I have to make closure on the past, and that's not any more part of my reality, then I'm going to be a miserable person. Because the past is gone. I don't know if my parents are still alive. My old religion is a thing of the past. Now, if I come to terms with the new circumstances and make the best of it, then I'll be able to continue to exist nicely. If I don't come to terms with it, I'll be miserable. So this woman cries for 30 days. Crying over here is a closure. She realizes that her mother and father are no longer in her life, either because they don't exist anymore, because there's no connection with them anymore, but because of the reality of the situation. Her old religion is not in her life, so she has to come to closure and to realize that she has to accept this the way things are. That's Elul. Elul is coming to closure with things that you may not regret, but that you have to come to the reality that maybe you have to stop them anyway, even if you don't regret them. So that's a connection between Elul and this captive woman. Okay. Next. The next thing I want to discuss is not the next thing in the Sedra, but Ben Soru Mora. You have a child who is just bar mitzvah. For the first 6 months after his bar mitzvah, this halacha applies. After that, it doesn't apply anymore. The Gemara says that it never really happened because there are too many conditions that make it almost impossible. It was written in the Torah that we should learn from it. Ideas of education or whatever. Okay. So what can we learn from this? What happens? You have a kid who he doesn't listen, not, doesn't accept any discipline, just the opposite. He's a sorer. He leaves the path of the Torah when it comes to doing negative things, and he doesn't do positive things. He doesn't do mitzvahs, and he does averus. Sorer umore. Others say, so rare is he doesn't listen. What's it called? He doesn't listen to the Torah. And more, he wants to teach his parents. He thinks he knows better. He's a more. He wants to tell them what to do. Okay. And in addition, he doesn't accept any authority. And he is a glutton and a drunk. He eats an excessive amount of meat. And he drinks an excessive amount of wine from money that he stole from his parents, and then went and bought the meat and wine out of their rishus. Okay. Now, the parents see they can't do anything with this kid, so they bring him to court. And they tell the court that this kid is incorrigible. Right? He's 13 years old, and he's a real bar mitzvah bacher. His bar mitzvah drasha was eating treif and not listening to the mitzvahs, and he doesn't listen to us, and he wants to teach us what to do, to run our lives. And he stole from us, and he's a glutton, and he's a drunkard. Okay, 13-year-old. So the Beis Din gives him lashes, 39 lashes. and they warn him, don't do this again. Change your ways. Then he does it again. All these same things again. Right? Doesn't listen to his parents, steals from them, buys wine, meat, and the wine and meat have to be kosher. Can't be trade. Because if it's trade, he probably won't do it again. But kosher already, just the question is. So he's basically, the Ibn Ezra says, not because he's living in this world just for the sake of this world. That's his whole life, his physical pleasures. He's not disciplined at all, right? Doesn't listen to his parents. And therefore, there's pretty much no hope for this kid, at least the Torah says. And therefore, if we have to listen again, we bring him to Beis Din again, this time we stone him to death. The parents have to bring him. If the parents are mochel him and they don't want to bring him, they don't have to. The Gemara says, why such a terrible, what did he do? He stole some money. He bought some meat. He's a drunkard. For that you get death penalty? So the Gemara knew that if a kid at 13, those 6 months of the beginning of his adult life, this is what he's like, it's just going to get worse. And he's going to end up, what's it called, desecrating the Shabbos and killing people in order to keep up his habits. And he's going to end up dying and losing his world to come too. So better he should die now and lose his world, this world, than he should lose the world to come. In any case, part of the conditions are the parents have to have one voice. They have to sound the same. Either the father has a falsetto voice or the mother sounds like a truck driver. One of the two. Okay? They can't have different voices. They can't be, what's it called, missing an arm, because they have to point to the kid and say, B'neinu Zeh. They can't be blind, because they have to be able to say, this kid, that they can see it. And they can't be deaf, because Einenu Shomer, he doesn't hear, but we hear what we say. Can't be deaf, they can't be mutes, they can't be missing an arm, they can't be blind, and they have to talk with one voice. They have to sound the same. So obviously, all these conditions are almost impossible. And plus, the kid has to stop to steal money from the parents, stop to eat glatt kosher meat, what's it called, and a certain amount of wine. So it didn't happen. What did we learn from there, though? I think Rosh Hashanah for her says something similar, and that is, why do the parents have to have the same voice? Because if the parents can't, all these things, if the parents can't see the kid and point and say, this is our son, they can't identify him, then how do you expect the kid to be educated? In order to educate a child, you have to know who he is. Because the same education doesn't apply to every child. Every child, chanoch l'naro, pidarko, teach a child according to who he is. So if you give generic education to all children, right, so in school they may have to do that because they can't give different education to 30 kids in a class. A teacher, it's impossible for a teacher to do that. But at home, you can give your child individual attention, no matter how many kids you have. And you can deal with each child differently. But if the parents are blind, or they can't point at the child, right, then they can't identify that child. If the parents are deaf, they don't hear what the child has to say. How do you know who a child is? Rasha, ma omer. How do you know the kid's a Rasha? Because of what he says, how he asks. You can't know a child unless you know what he asks. If you're deaf, you can't hear what he has to say. Okay, this is all euphemistically. And if they don't speak in the same voice, the child hears one thing from the mother and something different from the father. They don't give the same message, then what do you expect? Like, what kind of education can you have? A child like that's going to use the parents against each other. And he'll listen to the mother when it suits him against the father, and he'll listen to the father when it suits him against the mother. So that there's no education. So what we learn from here is that if you want a child to be responsible to the point where he can be punished for what he does, then the parents have to have one voice in educating him. They have to be able to identify that child and what's it called and deal with him as a individual. Okay. It's interesting for those that are very important to them, equality. Okay, this does not apply to a girl. You can't have a bas soromora. A girl does all these things would still not get the death penalty. So there is discrimination in Yiddishkeit. and men are discriminated against, that they get death penalties from if they do these things and women don't. I don't know why, because it would be nice to say, well, girls are never really that bad, right? And they really, what's it called, you know, it's only boys. But that's not true. I mean, there's plenty of girls in this world that are really monsters, right? I was thinking, Mom, it's just the opposite, almost. Okay, my experience has been, both with most of my daughters, okay, we won't mention Tzipora, who you know, but except for one of them, I'll leave that open so you never know which one. But in any case, with my own daughters, and being a rabbi and seeing hundreds of other daughters grow up, girls, like, wake up one morning when they're around 13, around then, 12, 13, and they turn into monsters. And they remain like that till they're about 18, 19, then they wake up one morning and they're normal again. I tell people who never had teenagers, you know, and they're going into that stage of their lives, and they said, I don't understand, I don't recognize my daughter. Yes, she's such a sweet, nice, what's it called, obedient little girl, and all of a sudden, I woke up this morning and there's somebody else in the house. I said, look, have patience, it lasts for a few years, and after that, they just turn back. So it could be, by boys, that's not the case. Boys turn to monsters, they remain monsters. But girls turn to monsters, somehow it's part of their makeup, and that in a few years they become normal again. Right? Baruch Hashem worked that way with all my kids, and I see it with other people too. And I don't know, does this sound like a syndrome that sounds, well-known, or... Right? Yeah, okay. Okay, in any case, let's go on to the next thing. Okay, the Torah prohibits, speak of a little bit of halacha. Torah prohibits cross-dressing. Men dressing like women and women dressing like men. So obviously, to do it for sexual purposes, right, that men should disguise themselves as women and women as men, and that leads to promiscuity, that for sure is awesome. The question is, does it apply to other situations also? Well, you're not doing it for that reason. For instance, you're doing it because you want to have a play, right? And it's an all-girl play, and there's boy parts. So the girls put on tzitzis and they dress up like boys, or the opposite. It's an all-boys play, and there's girls' parts. So the boys dress up as girls. Or Purim, want a masquerade, right? And a boy wants to get dressed up as a kala, or a girl wants to get dressed up as a man. Is that okay or not? So the Shulchan Aruch says it's okay. Because since it is not for promiscuity, that's not what the Torah prohibited. There are many opinions who argue on the Shulchan Aruch and say that it is not a proper thing, that it's aser even if you're doing it not for promiscuous purpose, still aser. The Mishnah Berurah says it's better not to do it. It's better not to have men dress up as women and women as men. And even if you want to rely on the lenient opinions and do it, you shouldn't do it in a way that you look completely, a man looks like a woman or a woman looks like a man, but they leave one garment that you can see that it's who it is, right? In other words, that you can wear a woman's garment, but people know that you're a man, you're wearing what you call men's clothing also, and or vice versa. That makes it less of a problem. There's another way that it could be mutter. And there we are, makel, as long as it's clear that the woman is a woman or whatever. And that is for health reasons or for cold, hot. My person's going skiing. Woman's going skiing. So I never went skiing, but I can imagine that under the circumstances, wearing a skirt could be very uncomfortable when you're skiing. So people wear ski pants. Okay. So the woman's not wearing ski pants because she wants to look like a man. She's wearing ski pants because, according to what she's doing, right, it is very uncomfortable to do it in a woman's skirt. So there are heterim for women to wear ski pants. However, it's preferable that she wear a dress over the ski pants, right? And that way people know she's a woman, and still the pants are okay. Yeah. That's a different story. Now, depends what the beged is, right? For a woman to wear an arba kanfos is only a question of beged ish. It's not a question of tznius, right? For a woman to wear pants, yeah, pants is a different story. Pants probably is not beged ish, because if I came here in women's pants, right, it would be a problem of beged isha, right? Because those are not the same kind of pants that men wear, that women wear. Okay, they're completely cut differently, made differently, obviously. The problem with women wearing pants is it is not sanua, usually. Because it's not modest. For the sake of modesty, I'm not going to go into the details why it's not modest, but you can understand for yourselves that for a woman to wear clothing that accentuates the fact that her legs are separate is not a tsanua thing.
Yeah. If there's a condition that a woman wears a smooth-looking pant where you can't tell them necessarily if it's a pant or there's a big...
culottes.
Yeah. Then they're not collectively doing anything wrong.
It depends. On the one hand, yeah. If tsanias-wise, it probably is not a problem because it's wide kind of things. And it's not a beged ish. If a man would wear those kind of things, he'd have a problem that he's wearing something that's made for women specifically. However, since in the place where you live, that is not an accepted norm, right, if that's the case, then doing something that is not the accepted norm attracts attention, which is also not sunnah. And therefore, in a place where, let's say, only Arabs wear pants under their skirt, okay? And Jewish women, for the most part, don't do that. For a girl to wear pants under a skirt, which has become now a style, okay, and because it became a style, it may not be something that's a problem except in places where it's not a style. That could be a problem also. Doing something that makes you stand out, right, even if intrinsically it is not sanua and it's not man's clothing, that may also be a problem. But taking away all those things, right, could be no problem. Okay. Next, Kansipur. The Torah gave a mitzvah. According to most opinions, or according to some opinions at least, there is no mitzvah to look around to fulfill this mitzvah unless it chance upon it. You don't have to run around all day looking for bird's nests to shoo away the mother. But if you chance upon a nest with a bird, a mother bird that's kosher, sitting on eggs or with young, and now comes the second problem. Do you want the eggs? Do you want those little chicks? Okay, if you want them, then the Torah said you can't take them unless you send the wed mother away. Okay. What if you don't want them? I don't want eggs. I'm not going to eat pigeon eggs. Right? I don't need little pigeons. Not interested at all. Is there a mitzvah to send away the mother and take the eggs? Or if you don't want them, leave the nest alone. Right? There are two different opinions. One opinion says that there is if you chance upon a nest like that, there is a mitzvah to send the mother away. Even if you don't want the eggs, take the eggs, do something with them, whatever. But you don't have to say what to do. The other opinion says, no, if you don't want the eggs, leave the nest alone. Question is, what's the idea behind the mitzvah? The Torah doesn't say a reason. But there are different ideas given in Kabbalah, in Rambam Mor Nevuchim. Some of them are very rational reasons, and that is the following. Let me tell you some rational reasons. According to that, if you don't want the eggs, there's absolutely no reason to do this. It's the opposite. Leave the nest alone. One reason is that you are taking advantage of the mother's motherly instinct to capture her when you take her children. Because normally the mother would run away and you couldn't catch her. But the mother has these motherly instincts and she's not going to leave her eggs. She's going to keep coming back. So you're going to be able to catch her easily because of her motherly... Don't take advantage of her motherly instincts to catch her. Let her go away. Take the kids. That's only if you want the kids. If not, better to leave the whole thing. Another possibility is that Torah is interested in ecology. Right? You want to take the birds, you want to take the eggs, but don't prevent that mother from having other eggs and other birds that they can continue on the species. So don't take the whole thing for yourself. Leave the mother and let her produce other eggs and other little birds for other people. Right? So it's an idea of ecology, total ecology. According to that also, if you don't want the eggs or whatever, why bother with this whole thing? Right? Don't send the mother away. Don't take the eggs if you don't want them. Right? Don't, if you want them, don't be a pig and take everything. Let the mother go and she can provide for others. However, the Zohar says a different reason. So according to those reasons, it would seem that the mitzvah is only if you want the eggs or the young, then there's a mitzvah, send away the mother. According to the Zohar, though, the Zohar says like this. And when you come across a bird's nest with the mother there, everything in this physical world has a spiritual counterpart. And what happens to the physical thing here affects the spiritual forces in heaven, which are corresponding to that. There is a world in heaven which is called the bird's nest. Okay? It's not a bird's nest. It's a spiritual force that corresponds to a bird's nest here. The mother bird, okay, is a spiritual force, okay, that when it cries, it brings Mashiach closer. It's like the mother crying for her children. It's like God's presence crying for the Jewish people in Golus. And the crying itself helps to bring Mashiach closer. Therefore, when you send the mother bird away in this world and she cries, it, induces the crying of the spiritual force in the spiritual world and helps bring Mashiach closer. Therefore, even if you don't want the babies, you don't want the eggs, there's still a mitzvah to send away this mother, because since you chanced upon this mitzvah, it's a sign that if you're going to do it, it's going to create this spiritual power. In addition, it's brought down that fulfilling this mitzvah is a skula to have children. That's why people who have difficulty having children look around to fulfill this mitzvah. Because it's a skula to have children, because it awakens that mercy of the mother for the children in the spiritual world and induces children to be born. So according to those reasons, those are Kabbalistic reasons, it's not just if you want the children or the eggs, but just to do it, even if you don't want the children or the eggs, there's something to do it. Okay. This has to be only where you chance upon it, meaning it's not in your possession. Because otherwise, how could you ever have your eggs? If you have a chicken farm, every time you want to go take the eggs, you have to send away your chickens, right? It's going to be a losing proposition. So it doesn't apply to birds that are in your domain. Only birds that are hefker. Then, baderech. So what happens if you have a nest in your house? There's no mitzvah. If the nest is outside your house, on your windowsill, and it's not, you weren't koneh, it's hefker, the birds are not within your domain, then there's a mitzvah. They're in your domain, then there's no mitzvah.
I have another situation, so I'm going to ask you a question. So, you're not tired to send away the mother bird? So I just want to clean out my attic. And went through the eaves and set up a nest.
In the attic.
Yeah,
probably there's no mitzvah to send away the mother bird.
So the best is to but it's merciful to do it?
Take the whole nest and move them.
Knowledge?
No, take the whole nest and move it somewhere. Don't touch the eggs. If you touch the eggs, the mother will never come back. If you don't touch the eggs, take it with a towel or something.
Set up nest in the eaves of my
head. I said, so bring it outside and the mother will find her, maybe.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Has to be a kosher bird. And it has to be that the mother, sometimes the father sits on the, depends how equality minded the birds are. Right? Especially today, most of the time the fathers are sitting on the eggs, not the mother. But how do you know? So there are ways of knowing by time. Fathers sit on the eggs, I think, in the daytime, and the mothers at night. And there's a time after sunset, or whatever. There's a whole svarim on this. right? I'm not a bucky in the thing, but I know there are, you can tell by different birds, if it's the father or the mother, based on the time of day that the bird's there. And also there are simanim of the coloring of the bird, whether it's a male or a female. So you have to get close enough to see. Okay, in any case. One more thing. Torah says you shouldn't wear shatnes, wool and linen together, and gedilin tassa, but you're allowed to wear tzitzis that are shatnes. Meaning, in the time when we had tcheles, or for those people who have tcheles today, so the halacha is that if you have a garment of linen, you have to put a strand of blue tcheles of wool on that garment. Tcheles is dyed wool, no other thing. Tcheles has to be wool. And if you have a linen garment with four corners, so the halacha is you put the wool strand on the thing and shatnez. But the Torah itself said that the mitzvah of tzitzis pushes away the prohibition of shatnez. There's another case where shatnez is permitted by big day kahuna, by the clothing of the kohanim, the kohen gadol. They were made of wool and linen. In fact, there is an opinion that the reason the Torah prohibited wearing shatnez is because since the kohanim wore this clothing, wearing shatnez would be like taking something holy and making it profane. But in any case, that's the Torah doesn't say a reason for the mitzvah of shatnez. But I'm going to tell you that according to the idea behind it, kabbalistically, the idea of wearing tzitzis or bitei kahuna of shatnez fits perfectly with the reason why shatnez is prohibited, and here it doesn't apply. It's not just the Torah said it's okay, here the Torah said don't do it, here the Torah said do it, seems to be contradictory. It's not only not contradictory, it all works together. The Zohar says that one of the ideas behind shatnez, not the reason for it, but one of the ideas, is it goes back to the beginning of the world. Cain brought a sacrifice from he was a farmer, he brought it from his produce. But he didn't bring from the best, he didn't bring from the nice fruits that he could eat. You know what he brought? Flax, linen, as a sacrifice. Hevel was a shepherd, he brought from his choice sheep. What was that? Wool. So right away in the beginning of the world, wool and linen couldn't get together. Cain and Hevel, Cain killed Hevel. Why? Because they were looking for covet. Everybody wanted the covet of, you know, who's going to be the main one in this world. So when it comes to covet, wool and linen can't get together. What is covet of a person's clothing? Right? Clothing gives you covet. So when it comes to covet, wool and linen is a remembrance of the fight of Cain and Hevel. Can't put them together in your clothing. That's only clothing that you wear for your honor. But what about clothing you wear for God's honor? Nothing to do with your honor. Tzitzis. Big day kahuna. The other reason doesn't apply. You're not wearing it for your honor where the Cain and Hevel conflict is pertinent. You're wearing it for God's honor. Therefore, that does not pertinent. Therefore, shatnez is okay. Okay, that's not the reason. It's just an idea. Right? Because the Torah doesn't say the reason. But according to this idea, it fits in very nicely why this is the exception.